Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She hopes to be back on the air next week. Rescuing boaters, investigating a fuel spill, and proposing new standards for water release from boat holds, these are a few of the hundreds of tasks the U.S. Coast Guard has performed in recent days. More than half of the United States population lives within 50 miles of a coast. Even so, David Helvarg of the Blue Frontier Campaign, an ocean conservation group, says most people don't understand the scope of the Coast Guard's mission and its critical search and rescue role. He describes the work of the Coast Guard in a new book. It's called Rescue Warriors, America's Forgotten Heroes. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of blame going around. But here's what a GAO report said about the Coast Guard. Of the estimated 60,000 people needed to be rescued from rooftops and flooded homes, over 35,000 were saved by the Coast Guard. Underpinning these efforts were the agency's operational principles that promote leadership, accountability, and enable personnel to take responsibility in action. So at a time FEMA and other government agencies were really getting hammered, the Coast Guard seemed at Katrina to really do its job. Why do you think that happened?
Exactly. I mean, when I got there to cover it, it was clearly the only part of government that was functioning there. And part of it is because that's what they do. They rescue people in the water, whether it's on the high seas or in flooded cities. There was also a particular reason in terms of the creation of Department of Homeland Security, which had taken place a short time before. When it did, the Coast Guard's friends in Congress added a Section 888 to the Homeland Security Act, saying that the secretary had no power to impact the multi-mission roles of the Coast Guard. They were concerned that they would lose their ability to do fisheries enforcement, aids to navigation, and particularly search and rescue. But so while the rest of the federal and state government were arguing over jurisdiction and showing scary examples of incompetency, the Coast Guard did what it does every hurricane season in every situation. It pulled its resources out of the direct path of the hurricane, pre-positioned them, surged assets in, and as soon as the hurricane came ashore, they came in on the backside of the storm and started rescuing people.
So what exactly did they do there?
They came in first with air assets, started pulling, you know, within 8 hours of Katrina making landfall, they were pulling the first people off of, I think the first folks was a woman, her grandmother, and her baby pulled out of a boat that was jammed under a tree south of the city. The pilot I was talking to when I got to the air station, his first rescue was a man and his dog who had cut a hole through his roof to get on the roof, and they were still in high winds and had to extend the cable, you know, because of the wind conditions. They took the rescue cable down almost to the end of its line. I was impressed for several reasons. One is their access. I mean, I was down there, and I'd heard that the, you know, I'd worked with other services like reporting on the Navy and other services where you traditionally, if you're going to report on something, you have to wait for the chain of command. So I heard that their district command had moved up to St. Louis. So I was going through New Orleans and the flooded Plaquemine Parish along the coast, calling for days. I finally got through to a lieutenant in St. Louis. I said, I'd like to visit the air station. He says, well, why don't you? I said, well, don't I need? He says, no, go to the gate, ask whoever's doing public affairs. I got there. We're already 2 weeks after the storm, and Katrina's come and Rita's approaching, and it looked like a combination MASH unit in Woodstock. Everybody was still living on cots and in trailers. I buzzed at the gate. I was let in. The public affairs person said she was busy. Go out on the flight line and start talking to people, which I did, and was being offered shortly overflights of damaged oil platforms offshore, and realized this is a service that not only trusts its people to act on their own, but to speak for themselves. At that point, I realized that I'd always wanted to write a story on the Coast Guard. I've lived on the ocean most of my life and seen them as people who are out there, knew them as most people know them, people who save sailors and people in the water in distress. I didn't know their other functions. I knew I wanted to write a book on them. I realized they were providing me the access that I could. So I spent 2 years after Katrina going from Kodiak, Alaska, to the North Arabian Gulf off Iraq, where they're guarding oil terminals. And last fall, when Hurricane Ike came ashore in Texas, flew in with them, and again saw from the inside out how they do this, how they surge resources in, and they start, you know, rescuing people first at search and rescue, and then that immediately rolls over into medical response and environmental response.
Well, you write about this as being really part of the Coast Guard culture, that they have this autonomy to make decisions on the spot, which is different from, as you say, your experiences with a lot of government agencies, military and otherwise, where there's a chain of the command and everyone's very nervous about having a report around. Why does the Coast Guard have this distinctive culture?
Well, part of it is they have a history going back over 219 years to when they were founded by Alexander Hamilton. He, depending on who you talk to, it goes back either to 1789 or 1790 when he founded the Lighthouse Service and the Revenue Service, depends if you like, you know, lights or wooden boats. But they've had this history of having to respond to all forms of navigable waters. And so their ability to improvise is rooted in a history of responding in this very rough environment. I mean, the oceans, the Great Lakes, our rivers. And part of it is a default. They've always been so small and relatively starved for resources. There are only 42,000 active duty coasties, as they call themselves, another 8,000 reservists. So they have to push responsibly down to the lowest level. So you have enlisted people who are in charge of driving 47-foot boats and larger, and also running the surf shops, the rescue swimmer shops, the surf stations that go out, that train elite forces to go out in 30-foot seas and 50-knot winds to rescue boaters or go into 8-foot surf, breaking surf, and pull windsurfers and surfers out of the lineup without smashing their bottoms.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. I'd like to talk for a moment about the role the Coast Guard fulfilled on 9/11. Really an incredible effort there. Tell us what they did.
They were responding when the second plane hit. There were several responses. The CO up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, remembered a fire in Puerto Rico where people had been trapped on the roof. And he launched two H-60 helicopters, Jayhawks, from there on his own authority when he couldn't get higher up. They tried to get to the roof at the North Tower after the first collapse. They were ordered down because they were told the Air Force would shoot down anybody over the city. And one of the pilots was arguing we're the rescue force, but they were forced to land as they got on the radio to try and make the argument to move on. The second tower was lost.
If they had not been ordered to stand down, could some of the people?
They're convinced they would have saved some of the people on the North Tower.
And was anyone ever held accountable for this? It seems like such a heartbreaking tragedy.
It was the chaos of the moment. What happened then is, as the smoke from the towers created panic in South New York, they had initially, after the second plane struck, shut down the harbor. At that point, Vessel Traffic Control, which was the Coast Guard, ordered all working boats in the harbor to go to South Manhattan. And you had this flotilla. One of them I talked to who was there at Battery Park, he said it was like the scene from The Longest Day. He turned around and looked through the smoke, and through the smoke emerged this fleet of tugboats and fast ferries and fireboats. And the Coast Guard was able to coordinate the evacuation of 500,000 people off lower Manhattan and avoid the panic that was setting in at the water's edge.
So it gave people another way to get away from the area.
The main way to get away. Yeah. Most people, I grew up in New York, and most people don't understand it's 80% of the city is disconnected from the mainland. We're a water city. And this was, people think everybody evacuated over the Brooklyn Bridge. 500,000 people were taken off by water.
Has there ever been a maritime evacuation of that many people in that period of time?
This is the largest in history, as far as anybody knows.
And with no preparation.
It's, as I say, it's what they do. They're trained to respond, and if they don't have the resources, improvise in water situations in this very tough environment of our oceans and harbors. And of course, 9/11 transformed the Coast Guard in other ways from there.
And how did they even let this odd collection of vessels, how did they even let them know that they should go there and help evacuate people?
On the marine radio, the Coast Guard, the captain of the port in every major port is a Coast Guard officer. And they put the word out on Channel 16, which is the Coast Guard emergency radio frequency, and on the other. And of course, like many New Yorkers, the tugboat captains, the ferry captains, they were ready to respond. They were looking for how they could help. They also brought in the strike team from New Jersey. The environmental strike team was the first on scene. They declared Ground Zero a hazardous site.
This is the Coast Guard strike team.
Coast Guard mm-hmm. strike team. There are three national strike teams the Coast Guard has that respond to oil spills, hazardous wastes, other disasters. And they arrived, and their immediate response was they started, you know, seeing all these hazardous wastes at the rubble pile. They ordered people to wear respirators. They began to set up decontamination stations, at which point the EPA came in and declared there wasn't an air quality problem. By the end of the week, it was very frustrating for the Coast Guard strike team commanders. They set up decontamination showers. They were told you can't even use the word decontaminate. And so they had to create incentives like bottled water and chairs for the workers to rest at to get them into the decontamination.
Of course, we know with the passage of time that there were lots of environmental problems, personal health problems that have resulted from the people
of respiratory disease as a result of the rest of the government not responding right at the time.
Why did the EPA not want the Coast Guard to go ahead with what it was doing there?
Looking back at it, there was some response. We know that Karl Rove in the White House and others in the White House didn't want to create panic. And that was the wrong way of not creating panic, obviously, to put the workers at risk. A more responsible way was the chief of naval operations called Jim Loy, who was then commandant of the Coast Guard. And it was agreed that putting Coast Guard cutters with their white hulls, putting them into New York Harbor, would reassure the public in a way that naval ships of war wouldn't. So that week, the Coast Guard began to build up its security capacity to go from a peacetime to a wartime footing.
We're talking to David Helvarg. He's written a new book. It's called Rescue Warriors, the U.S. Coast Guard, America's Forgotten Heroes. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones, 1-800-433-8850. We'll read some of your emails. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We'll talk to him when we come back about why he calls them forgotten heroes. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Sitting with me in the studio is David Helvarg. He's a conservationist and an author, a journalist. He's written a new book. It's called Rescue Warriors, the U.S. Coast Guard, America's Forgotten Heroes. So tell me, why do you call them America's Forgotten Heroes?
Well, they're the smallest and least known of the armed services. And part of that is because they're in this unique situation. They're both the military service and law enforcement. And a kind of institutional orphan for over 200 years. They've come under the Department of Treasury, the Department of Navy, Department of Transportation, and most recently, in 2003, transferred to the Department of Homeland Security. I think there's also a larger historical reason, which is throughout history, rite of passage for our young men is to send them off to war, and those who survive become our tribal and national leaders. The difference today is we're a much more crowded, interdependent planet. Our enemies, our threats are not just coming from other guys with guns. It's environmental, climate change, intensified hurricanes, more people living in harm's way on the coast. It's pirates and pandemics and an unknowable range of threats. And to be able to respond to those threats on a planet that's two-thirds saltwater, I mean, to me, defines who the Coast Guard is and what it does.
Do people in the Coast Guard feel like they're forgotten, that they don't get the credit that the other members of the armed forces get?
I think they feel that way. They kind of suck it up and live with it. They get credit from each other and tremendous job satisfaction from being able to save lives. They claim they've saved over a million lives since 1790. I sort of did the math and figured they're counting 350,000 migrants who they've taken off the water. Generally, most of those migrants aren't too happy to see the white hulls of the Coast Guard unless they're in the actual process of overturning and sinking. But 2 weeks ago, they saved 113 migrant Haitians out of 170 in an overloaded boat that sank. The week before, they picked up another 120 in a completely unseaworthy boat. So, but let's say it's only 750,000 souls they've saved in the course of their institutional career. It's not bad, and I've talked to a lot of their folks, including a lot of their gunners, their armed responders that have grown from 300 to 3,000 since 9/11. And I think at a genetic level, they still get their biggest thrill out of saving lives.
We talked before the break about the remarkable role the Coast Guard played on 9/11. Tell us how their mission changed, though, as a result of the September 11 attacks.
Well, you have to remember, because of their orphanages, lack of support and misplacement, they were going through a decade of cutbacks leading to 9/11. In fact, they were facing a 10% cutback that year. And since 9/11, they've grown from a $5 billion to over $9 billion budget, but almost all of that has been on the security side. And the safety and stewardship side have not kept pace, so that there is a threat to core competency in terms of other missions like ship inspection, response to oil spills. I've got a chapter called Duck Scrubbers. I mean, the Coast Guard's been doing environmental response since 1822. But when we had a ship crash 2 years ago in San Francisco Bay and 33,000 gallons of oil spill, 35,000 gallons, the Coast Guard response was not great. I was actually speaking to the admiral in charge that morning that the ship hit the bridge. And he was telling me, not realizing he was speaking in the present tense, he was saying because of this focus on security, we're beginning to lose that core competency on the safety and stewardship side. And my own sense is with all the expanding mission sets, including the Arctic, where we have this fifth blue water coast emerging that the Coast Guard is now setting up search and rescue and security stations up there, you can't do it with an organization the size of the New York Police Department. I think in the next decade, you need to double the size and double it again by 2030 so that you have an organization closer in size to the Marine Corps than the New York Police.
You use the word duck scrubbers. Who are duck scrubbers?
Duck scrubbers, the oil spill response. They also call them fish kissers, the guy who does fisheries enforcement. But fisheries enforcement and environmental protection, that's core to our national security, to our food security. These are missions that are essential to protecting our public seas.
You also write about surfmen. Who are surfmen?
The surfmen are a number of women who are also designated surfmen. These are the folks in the small boat stations, a lot on the West Coast, who respond, who are trained up to respond to conditions that are unbelievable. I mean, they used to say back when it was a life-saving service, the logo was, you have to go out, you don't have to come back. Now they've sort of married a risk assessment and constant training so that they can do it safely. But what they can do safely is go out in these 30-foot seas and rescue people. I went up to Cape Disappointment, visited the boat training school up there, and it's amazing what they're able to do with these small boats.
We've got an emailer who says she is a Katrina evacuee, and she says, thank you. We in New Orleans remember the Coast Guard. Let's go to Ramey, who's calling us from Birmingham, Alabama. Ramey, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Ashley, you just answered one question I was going to ask, but I had a second part. I had a question about how the role of the department had changed since 9/11, but my other question I wanted to ask is I was actually shocked what the latter President Bush had done. I always took a great sense of pride in the fact that the Coast Guard came under the jurisdiction or was affiliated with the Navy, as was the Marine Corps, as is the Marine Corps. I was wondering, I wanted to get your reaction to my train of thought that Bush used the 9/11 attack as an excuse to politicize the other agencies, including the Coast Guard.
All right, Ramey, thanks so much for your call.
Well, I think the Coast Guard was and is somewhat insulated against politicization because it is, as I say, both the law enforcement and military service. The Commandant, Admiral Thad Allen, actually took initiative on Arctic policy when he saw nobody else was dealing with the fact that we have this meltdown up there. And in the last few years, he had to finesse it to the degree that he would say, I don't know the science. All I know is there's a lot more open water up there, and that's my responsibility to deal with it.
Was within the Coast Guard, was it a popular or unpopular move to be put in the Homeland Security Department?
They didn't have a lot of say about it. I think that they went from the Department of Transportation, where they had about as much influence as Amtrak, where the big money was always focusing on the highway bill, to becoming a big fish in a dysfunctional pond. And I know today that there are some flag officers, that's admirals and above, and a lot of other folks who just feel the traditional misfit, that their mission is everything wet, be it salty, brackish, or fresh. And the Homeland Security has really focused almost exclusively on the counterterror and port security side. So, I mean, my own imagining would be we take the Coast Guard out of Homeland Security, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration out of Commerce, and create a Department of Oceans. And it's not really my idea. It's been suggested by several major commissions over the years. It may at the moment not be politically practical, but it's, I think, what would be in the public interest.
We have a caller from Little Rock, Arkansas. Diane, you're on the air.
Thank you very much, and thank you for writing the book. I wanted to comment about women in the Coast Guard, about the role that the spars played in World War II, and then they were mustered out. And then there was a small group, two groups actually, a total of 75, from 1964 to about 1967, that were put in the Coast Guard initially as reservists to see how it would work out. I was one of those 75. And then when President Johnson became president, he integrated fully women in the military. When women were then allowed in the Coast Guard and continue this day in all aspects.
Now, Diane, how long? So you served in the Coast Guard.
Yes.
And how long did you serve there?
It was a special program. I was only allowed to join in 1965 for 1 year of active duty for training, and then I spent the rest of the 2 years in a reserve unit in St. Louis. What was interesting about it, we weren't allowed to get our GI benefits because we were considered active duty for training, and one of our members decided to appeal this. And it was stated that because women were not allowed in the Coast Guard fully at that time, and women later had been integrated, it was like 10 years later, we were allowed to get our full GI benefit.
And exactly what did you do in the Coast Guard? What was your
job? This was the problem. We were only allowed to be a storekeeper, yeoman, and we couldn't, we had to stay on shore. And I worked in the 2nd Coast Guard District in St. Louis. This Coast Guard was very kind to us, made it a special experience, treated us extremely well, but we didn't have the occupation opportunities that mm-hmm. women have now. Now they're commanders of vessels. They fly helicopters. I don't think they're swimmers, but they do everything else.
They are swimmers.
Mm-hmm. Diane, thanks so much for your call, and thank you for your service.
Yes, thank you for your service, Diane. It's actually since the 70s, women are fully integrated. This is the only one of the armed services where women are not only in all the jobs, rescue swimmers and boat drivers and all the others. The second in command, Admiral Creo, who just resigned for personal reasons, had she not, there was a good chance she would have become the first female head of one of our armed services. When I was at the visiting the academy, the Coast Guard Academy in New London, it was 27% women, and the training center in Cape May for the enlisted was, I think, 23% when I visited there. It's a very attractive field for women who want to serve and yet want to be able to move up to the top ranks or go anywhere they choose to in their career.
Well, who is drawn? Who tends to be drawn to service in the Coast Guard?
It's a mix, and it also depends on the time. Certainly after 9/11, there was a lot of patriotic response. I find there are a lot of kids from service families, and they would tell me that, example cadet who would say, my dad's a Navy aviator. I always wanted to fly, but I wanted to pull people off of roofs, not drop bombs on them. The humanist mission that you want to save lives rather than take them. I was out off of Iraq with the Coast Guard where they're guarding oil terminals, and I was with them boarding Iraqi fishing vessels. And one night on the bridge, I was talking to a guy who'd spent 3-4 years in the Army. He said he quit September 1st, 2001 because he thought the U.S. was never going to war. Then he went to the Maritime Academy in California, joined the Coast Guard. I said, why didn't you go back to the Army? He said, well, my family's, we're all divers, and I lost my brother in a diving accident in 2001, and I just didn't have the urge to do that again, to do, you know, to risk possibly killing others, but I still wanted to serve. And I talked to the captain of the Monroe, which is one of the big high-endurance cutters, Bark Lloyd, up in Kodiak, Alaska. He says he asks every new sailor who comes on board what their parents do. It's a really high proportion, like over 10% their mothers are professional nurses. So he says, what you have is growing up with a parent who's a professional nurturer, and you want that, but you want adventure too. And so you have this very interesting mix of patriotism, altruism, and adrenaline.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Scott's on the line. Scott, from Brooksville, Florida. Scott, I understand you were in the Coast Guard yourself.
Yeah, I was in for over 25 years, from 78 to 2004. And I just want to say thanks, David, for bringing the attention to the Coast Guard.
And Scott, what did you do in the Coast Guard?
I started out as a non-rater seaman on a ship out of Gulfport, Mississippi, and worked my way up to became a yeoman, personnel type person, and then eventually made chief warrant officer, and became a housing officer, a transportation officer, you name it. And I think that's one of the things that David's touched on is the fact that the Coast Guard isn't infinitely specialized. Everybody does pretty much everything. I mean, I was in a pollution response team as a yeoman. I drove boats as a yeoman. I was on three ships as a yeoman. I mean, it's a different type of service.
We were talking just a moment ago about what draws people to enlist in the Coast Guard. What drew you?
My grandfather was in the Coast Guard back in World War II. Listening to him talk about it, and it just something that interested me as long as I could remember. And I was always around boats. My family owned a marina in Tennessee for a while, and so it was just something that I was always interested in.
And the subtitle of this book is America's Forgotten Heroes. Did you feel that way when you were in the Coast Guard, that you were somehow forgotten?
Well, it's, you know, they always, you see these public service announcements for the Army, Air Force, and Marines, and then they, you know, and then fine letters you see, and the U.S. Coast Guard, you know. So it is, it's one of the armed services, but people have a tendency to forget about it. And I think that's one of the things that David is pointing to, is that we are forgotten, but, you know, like he said, we do get recognition from each other, our families and friends, you know, but for the rest of society, it's the Coast Guard. Wow, what do, you know? And to tell them, when I was in, we were under the Department of Transportation, they were like, why? You know, and it didn't make sense to any of us, but there we were, so.
All right, Scott, thanks so much for your service.
And again, thanks for that, for your service. They were in the Department of Transportation because LBJ wanted a Department of Transportation, and he needed bulk, and essentially the Coast Guard was moved from Treasury for ballast. This is how they've kind of been treated historically, institutionally in Washington. But it's true. I mean, he was saying people don't know that they're operating globally, that they maintain 6,500 aids to navigation, big navigational buoys and weather buoys. Some people, even within the service families, I was flying in, they're kind of the 9/11 for the most dangerous catch. And so I was deploying on a C-130 with them where they were moving assets from Cold Bay, Alaska, up to St. Paul Island to follow the crab fleet, the cutters and helicopters are kind of like the eagles and orcas following them, making sure they're safe. And we're in this whiteout, and the co-pilot's talking about this issue. He says, you know, the day after 9/11, his wife turns to him in bed and says, it's so scary. Thank God you're not in the military.
We have a caller, Robert from Watertown, who says that he thought the Coast Guard should have been assigned the job of providing safety at airports after 9/11 instead of creating this transportation safety agency. Was there ever any talk of that?
No, there's talk of expanding their missions. Essentially, even though they do collaborate and have a lot of within DHS with TSA and others and do joint operations, they're primarily known as a waterborne organization. And they're not looking for new missions. They keep getting new missions without the funding to adequately meet them. So, for example, I mean, the Arctic is this huge environment and to operate, and they're moving into the west and the north of Alaska with their icebreakers. The Coast Guard runs America's icebreaking fleet, which at the moment is two, and having to deal with these intense environments without the resources to meet their needs.
We're talking to David Helvarg. He's written a new book called Rescue Warriors. He's written some previous books, too. One's called The War Against the Greens. He's written Blue Frontier and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. On that book, he did a previous appearance on The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds whose mission is to maximize the power of philanthropy to strengthen communities at fjc.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose financial reform project provides analysis to guide the debate over financial modernization at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Animal Week edition of Fresh Air, all creatures great and not so great. The directors of the documentary Earth tell us about filming polar bears and elephants. Biologist Doug Emlin describes the amazing world of the dung beetle. There's a lot going on under a pile of dung. And journalist Robert Sullivan finds an alley to observe rats. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page with USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're talking this hour with David Helvarg about his new book called Rescue Warriors, the U.S. Coast Guard, America's Forgotten Heroes. I'd like to read a couple emails. Here's one email we got from Carol, writing from Florida. She says, "My mother was rescued by boat off Battery Park on 9/11. We've always been so grateful to the boat owners that came over and evacuated people. Until today, I had no idea that the whole operation had been organized by the Coast Guard. There was no mention of this fact in the news. Thank you. We will be eternally grateful." And another emailer, Sarah, who's writing us from Hudson, Ohio, writes, "My son is in the Coast Guard. He works the winch on the rescue helicopters. He was stationed in Alabama during Katrina. His commander said, quote, go west and rescue people. So they did. He helped rescue many folks, including a very scared woman who tossed her baby at him as the basket came level with the helicopter. He caught the baby. We're glad to hear that. And here's another emailer who writes, my daughter is an officer in the Coast Guard. We are very proud of the accomplishments by her and her colleagues. She's an aviator who joined the Coast Guard because at that time there were more opportunities for women. Now, that's a point you meant that made that many women are drawn to the Coast Guard because of the opportunities for them there.
Yeah, it's, as I say, it's an opportunity to do a range of functions from law enforcement, you know, counter drugs to flying. A lot of transfers from other services like the Army come in because they can keep flying.
Here's an email from Kevin, who writes us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He says, my dad served in the Atlantic on the Sea Cloud, a converted luxury ship. It was credited with using depth charges to sink a Nazi submarine. What was the Coast Guard's role in World War II?
Well, they fought in every war in history. In World War II, their two major roles were escorts for the Liberty ships, the convoys in the North Atlantic, and taking on security. And also they drove the Higgins boats. They drove the landing crafts and all the amphibious landings from Guadalcanal to D-Day. And so they had a really high rate of casualties. In fact, this famous picture called the Jaws of Death of D-Day, where you see the front being lowered on one of these landing craft. And that was taken by the coxswain, who was Coast Guard, who was ferrying people back and forth to landing beaches. Their only Medal of Honor winner to date was Nane Monroe. He was out there in Guadalcanal and provided fire cover for Marines as they were retreating off the beach, and was killed in defense of those Marines.
We have wars going on now with U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is the Coast Guard role in those conflicts?
Small boat security. They have 110-foot cutters out there guarding the oil terminals, and they also have their law enforcement detachments, their LETA teams that are both training up Iraqi and other local forces, as well as I joined them doing that, boarding oil tankers and Iraqi fishing dhows. It was interesting. One of the Navy guys asked Hurricane Harker, John Harker, who was one of the guys I was with. The Navy guy said, well, what can you coasties teach us that we don't know? He says, well, I did 600 fishing boardings in my last post in New Hampshire. And later he told me that the Iraqi fishermen were actually a lot friendlier than some of the New England fishermen.
We have a caller, Carl. And, you know, Carl, I've got to take your call because you're calling us from Lighthouse Point, Florida, and it just seems too appropriate for this topic. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you have a caller question?
Well, just wanted to tell you about the Coast Guard Auxiliary, a civilian arm.
Mm-hmm.
I own the boat. I live on the water in southern Florida. Lighthouse is just north of Fort Lauderdale. I am lying now. I retired a couple of years ago. I had 33 years in the Coast Guard Auxiliary.
And, Carl, tell us what you did in the Coast Guard Auxiliary.
I am on the water in Florida. I had a radio station in my home. I operated my own boat and used it for search and rescue for people in South Florida waters.
And did you rescue very many people?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Very, very definitely a lot of people. I had also at one time was the commander of the Coast Guard Auxiliary Flotilla in Florida.
All right. And, Carl, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'll be 90 in October.
Well, happy birthday to you. Thank you for your service, and thank you for giving us a call. The Coast Guard Auxiliary
is an amazing way. One of the ways the Coast Guard kind of multiplies its forces is with 30,000 civilian volunteers like Carl who volunteer their boats and more recently aircraft. And essentially just for the price of fuel, they go out and help in search and rescue. They're particularly useful in boating safety. Which the Coast Guard Auxiliary runs boating safety programs across America. This weekend being Labor Day weekend, there's a lot of concern in the Coast Guard that they not have to respond to more casualties resulting from drunk boaters or letting 13-year-old kids off with their own personal watercraft. Their auxiliary, as I say, and the reserves are a tremendous force enhancement for the Coast Guard. Unfortunately, just because of the size and scale, over 70% of the reservists had to be mobilized after 9/11 at the beginning of the war. And so it's as capable as Coasties are, without additional resources, they're going to lose that ability, even with the auxiliary and other support.
One of the big jobs the Coast Guard does now involves trying to interdict drugs. Talk about their efforts on that front.
Oh, well, they're out there capturing more cocaine, for example, than the DEA, the FBI, all state, local law enforcement combined, simply because of the scale of shipping. You know, as they say, it used to be focused on the Caribbean. Now it's more in the Eastern Pacific. The saying is fewer runs but more tons. They've taken 13 tons at a single time. More typically, it'll be go-fast boats with floating gas stations, fishing boats that are actually functioning as gas supply for these go-fast boats. They'll go as far out as 600 miles off Ecuador, run around the Galapagos to try and get past the Coast Guard. So along with their own cutters, which are few and aged, they also have these law enforcement detachments, leadits, that ride on Navy ships. And they'll go 600 miles off the coast. They'll get out on a rigid hull inflatable at night and go over the horizon to sneak up on these drug runners. The Navy doesn't like to talk about it a lot because of posse comitatus. The Department of Defense is not allowed to do law enforcement. So before they'll do a drug raid, they'll raise the Coast Guard ensign above the Navy frigate, the ship, and it becomes a Coast Guard vessel, and they can go out and make the bust.
Because the rules are different for the Coast Guard.
Coast Guard is under Titles 10 and 14, both law enforcement and military, and so it can do things like migrant interdiction and drug interdiction and operate off many platforms. And facing, you know, a vast industry with the cartels, so that as they've taken down the go-fast, the cartels are now using semi-submersible submarines. They're liquefying cocaine, mixing it with fuel. And it's this constant cat-and-mouse game being played out there on the open seas.
Now, that means that the rules for the Coast Guard on what they can do if there's a federal declaration, what they can do in the absence of a federal declaration of martial law, that would be different as well. What are the differences?
Well, one of the things that's happening without a lot of public awareness is aerial use of force, which is that all the Coast Guard helicopter fleet is being armed up with armor and M240 machine guns and 50 caliber rifles. Now, they're already using the 50s to take out the engines on some of these go-fast drug boats when they refuse to stop. More recently, they've used shotguns with solid slugs to take out the engines on some of these predominantly Cuban smugglers, because there's different rules. Most migrants caught at sea will stop, and the Coast Guard will bring them aboard, give them food and water, and take them back to where their source of their home ports in Cuba and elsewhere. But Cuba's got special rules, kind of a leftover from the Cold War: wet foot, dry foot. If they make it to U.S. land and touch land, they get refugee status. And this has created an incentive for all these organized criminal gangs. They'll load up a go-fast boat with 30, 40 people and just go full bore. And if the Coast Guard tries to stop them, they're not stopping until they drop these people on shore. The result has been serious confrontations, a few deaths. Essentially, it's one of those legal problems that the Coast Guard has to deal with because they don't control the law. Wet foot, dry foot is kind of the equivalent of don't ask, don't tell for gays in the military. It just creates more problems for the way we deal with migrants, because the Cubans are this exception. And the exception, at one point, they landed a boatload of Cubans on the old causeway out to the Keys, the old highway bridge. And some lawyer decided that since it wasn't connected to the mainland, they were not on U.S. soil. And that created all sorts of huge controversy. A week later, the Conch Republic, which is kind of hard-drinking pseudo-independent nation in Key West, went out to the highway bridge, claimed it for the Republic, since the U.S. obviously didn't consider it their land.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Matthew. He's calling us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Matthew, thank you for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having me, and I want to thank you for the person that wrote the book. That's the Coast Guard. We love all the recognition we can get, so... I'm right outside Coast Guard City, USA, Grand Haven, Michigan. Have you heard of that?
I unfortunately not while I was writing the book, but I got to the annual Coast Guard Festival there. It's tremendous. Tell us about it.
It's a wonderful event. People come from all over the country in the Coast Guard. We get to celebrate with the city. The city does a lot of work for us in helping promote just the Coast Guard family, and it's great uniting with Coast Guard people from, you know, Florida, Hawaii. They come up for baseball tournaments, and you know, all the high brass is there. It's a wonderful event. But I would also like to highlight, there's a few things that I would like to share about the Coast Guard, is that we lost more lives in Vietnam than the Navy did. It's not necessarily a competition, but like, a lot of people don't realize that we're in the war footing. And then also we're over in the Middle East. There's suicide ships. We've lost members. We go to board vessels, and you know, they'll blow up they'll blow up the ships with us on it. So we've had to, like, kind of change our tactics on that as well.
Well, we had Nate Bruckenthal, I described. He was a Coast Guardsman lost in 2004 when they first set the security barriers around the big oil platforms off Iraq. He and three sailors were killed then. It's tough because people don't understand. They think of the Coast Guard as essentially along our coast and their actual area of operations, the entire blue part of our blue planet.
So, Matthew, you serve in the Coast Guard yourself?
Yeah, I served for a while. Actually, it's like the most competitive branch to become an officer. I applied to be an officer. I was accepted, but I didn't get a waiver because I'm slightly colorblind. In all the other branches, they allow people with a slight color deficiency to become officers, and the Coast Guard didn't allow that. So I ended up transferring to the Army, but the Coast Guard is just a wonderful branch. I loved every minute of it. While I was going through college, they worked with me so that I could, you know, drill in the summertime as a reservist. It's just a wonderful branch that's friendly for families. They do a lot of events, and it's also very friendly for college students because, you know, you can, you know, go to college, you know, in the fall and in the winter, and then you make up your drills in the wintertime as you're doing, you know, as they have increased, or you can make it up in the summertime when you have increased boating traffic.
All
and
right.
You're still eligible for the GI Bill. It's a wonderful branch to join.
Matthew, thanks so much for your service in both the Coast Guard and the Army.
Yeah, and as I say, there are problems. The problems with an underfunded agency that has more missions than it can accomplish. I have a chapter called Deep Water about a fiasco in terms of where they essentially gave major defense contractors power over their fleet expansion. And yet the bottom line is, as an investigative reporter, it was almost counterintuitive to find a part of government that works and that inspires one.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We actually have an emailer who talks about the Deepwater Project. His name is John, and he's writing us from Floresville, Texas. And he writes, I'm proud to have my youngest daughter and son-in-law served and serving in the Coast Guard. And he says he's benefited as a boater from the Coast Guard. But he says the Coast Guard is neglected to the point of hazard. Most of their cutters are 40 years old or older, and their aircraft aren't much younger. They make do with what they have. Breakdowns are an everyday part of life, and at sea they have a terrible potential for harm. The politically driven Deepwater Project wasted billions of dollars of a relatively low-budget service branch. Is it true that aging equipment is a big problem for the Coast Guard?
It's a huge problem. It's both the equipment and facilities onshore and offshore. You got on most of these cutters and you feel like you're visiting a maritime museum. And you are, because these most of them got commissioned in the late 60s, early 70s. They've been constantly in operation. You know, they're in operation every day of the year. And unfortunately, they tried. There's if there are two poles of power, money and people, they tried the money route. They tried to attach themselves to some of these top-tier defense contractors, and they got burned. And the only other way they're going to expand and have the growth they need, I think, is if people begin demanding that the service that returns the taxpayer dollar so well is given the resources it needs.
You've talked about some of the great variety of tasks that the Coast Guard tries to fill. One of them is environmental. What is the environmental role of the Coast Guard?
Since I spoke to a port director in Boston, she said, Coastie, she said that the first 10 years of her career was all about Exxon Valdez, and the next 10's all been about 9/11. The OPA 90, the oil spill response law that followed Exxon Valdez, gives $1 billion-plus oil spill response fund that the Coast Guard manages, and then the strike teams have to go out and be the first line of response when you have an oil spill, also chemical spills. The best part I saw was the preventative side, where I went with an inspection team in Boston onto an oil tanker, and they do investigations for ship safety that you don't get to the point where you have the spills, also for the illegal dumping of oily waste. And the CGIS, the Coast Guard Investigative Service, has done many operations that have resulted in multi-million-dollar fines against both shipping and cruise lines. Since 9/11, they don't have enough inspectors to cover this expanding fleet. You have 80,000-plus commercial vessels. They're all now equipped with what they call AIS, Automated Information Systems, to give a sense of who they are and where they are. But are they seaworthy? Not so much. In last April, they had to rescue. They managed to rescue 42 out of 47 fishermen, who were, whose ship, whose factory processor sank off of Alaska, and those factory processors are not fully inspected for safety because the law doesn't allow the Coast Guard to do its job.
Let's close with an email from Calvin. He writes us from Devil Hills, North Carolina. He says, not a day goes by here on the Outer Banks that we don't see and appreciate the Coast Guard. Daily in the summer season, we hear on the Marine Channel the Coasties going to the rescue or directing others to those in distress. And daily we see their huge white C-130s and helicopters flying along the beaches to pluck out some poor soul. They are an asset to this region and to the country. Well, David Helvarg, let me thank you for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show to talk about your new book, Rescue Warriors, the U.S. Coast Guard, America's Forgotten Heroes.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.